Welcome to The Lead from New Lines Magazine. I'm Danny Postel, the magazine's politics editor, and this is a podcast where we delve into the biggest ideas, events, and personalities from around the world. It was a year and a half ago, in September of 2022, that the Woman Life Freedom Movement exploded onto the scene in Iran. In response to the death in police custody of Mahsa Amini, a 22-year-old woman from Iran's minority Kurdish community who had been arrested by the so-called morality police for wearing her hijab improperly, quote-unquote. Protests swept to all of Iran's 31 provinces, rocking the Islamic Republic to its foundations. In response, Iranian security forces unleashed a massive campaign of repression, killing more than 500 people and detaining nearly 20,000. Persecution against participants in the movement has been ongoing, including several executions. Our guest on this episode, Arash Azizi, has a new book out on those momentous events and what they might portend for Iran's future. Titled, What Iranians Want: Women, Life, Freedom. We'll discuss that book and also Azizi's previous book, Shadow Commander, Soleimani, the U.S., and Iran's Global Ambitions. A frequent contributor to New Lines magazine, Azizi is a senior lecturer in history and political science at Clemson University. Arash, welcome to The Lead.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So Iran has seen its share of protest movements over the last 15 years. In 2009, there was the Green Movement with its slogan, Where is my vote? In 2017 and 18, there was widespread unrest over economic hardship. Protests began in the city of Mashhad, but spread to more than 140 cities and provincial towns. And then in 2019, after the government announced a hike in gas prices, protests broke out in the Khuzestan province in Iran's southwest and quickly spread to over 100 cities. And again, in early 2020, there were protests after the Revolutionary Guard shot down a Ukraine International Airlines flight that killed 176 people, including dozens of Iranians. But you argue that the Woman Life Freedom Movement that started in the fall of 2022 was arguably the most serious challenge to the regime's rule since 1979. How so, Arash? What made that movement different from those previous waves of protest?
I think a few things made it quite different. First of all, the movement in 2009, as you said, had started around the presidential election. It was a disputation of the presidential elections. The candidate who had claimed that the elections had been rigged against him was a former prime minister, a favorite of regime founder Ayatollah Khomeini. Now he would move on, Mirosa Musavi, politically he would move on. Today he advocates effectively an overthrow of the Islamic Republic, a constitutional change to it. But, you know, he was very much a regime insider before that. So the movement had started with those sort of goals. This time around, from the very beginning, the Woman Life Freedom Movement rejected the Islamic Republic in its entirety and effectively wanted a foundation of a new order. It had revolutionary colors from the beginning. The other differences with previous rounds of protests that you mentioned is that, first of all, this was truly nationwide protest all over Iran. None of the previous ones that you just mentioned were truly nationwide. I mean, they all happened all over Iran roughly. I mean, they sort of in different parts of the country. But the 2009 movement was really focused on Tehran and a few other big cities like Isfahan in central Iran, but the so-called minority majority regions of the borderlands of Iran were not as much central in the movement. And conversely, so 2017-18 and 2019-2020 movements, these two particular movements were focused on sort of smaller towns, especially like in Khuzestan, there were many sort of smaller towns. And they never really got going in Tehran effectively. They didn't have... they didn't really reach the capital in the same way. They were protesting solidarity with them, but nothing on a grand scale. So here you had a much more nationwide, much more sort of from the beginning revolutionary uprising. And it also was the case that it really brought together a variety of Iranians, truly sort of across ethnic boundaries, across class boundaries. It was a movement from the very beginning supported by trade unionists and middle class and ethnic minorities all over the country, the Baluch in the southeast, the Kurd in the western parts of the country. So all these reasons came together to give the movement a character of perhaps the most revolutionary challenge. I would also add that, for the first time, there was a bit of a momentum for the political opposition based abroad. Some attention was paid to them. Now they ended up really, not doing well in this. They didn't use this opportunity well. But the fact that the European and capitals and the Western capitals very seriously looked at them for a while, invited them to, Munich Security Conference, started having conversations about possible futures beyond the Islamic Republic. I mean, that's certainly the first time that has really happened since 1979 to that extent. So all of this makes it, the most serious challenge to the Islamic Republic in its entire history.
Right. So let's talk about how the Woman Life Freedom Movement went beyond the protests themselves, as widespread as they were, especially in those first several months. But even after the security forces cleared the streets, people still spoke of a movement that endured and transcended the demonstrations. In fact, you opened the book, Arash, with the slogan, "Don't call this a protest, this is a revolution," which was chanted by thousands of demonstrators and also spray painted as graffiti. That slogan, I think, kind of speaks to this point. So whether it's best understood as a revolution or a movement or maybe a revolutionary movement or a movement with revolutionary aspirations, whichever the case, does it still exist today in some sense, despite having been driven from the streets?
This is a very good question. The slogan, which really attracted an entire nation, I think it really encapsulated the demands of the movement. Of course, it was borrowed from the Kurdish movements in Syria and Turkey, the slogan "Woman Freedom," "Woman Life Freedom." And I think it really, many Iranians were very proud of this slogan. It also showed the high aspirations, if you will, sort of progressive aspirations that they held on to, that they didn't just want to get rid of one regime and replace it with another, but they wanted some fundamental changes, as is often the case in revolutionary movements. The question of whether it's still there or not is an interesting one. In some sense, it's not. You and I are speaking of in February of 2024. The repression of the regime is worse than ever. So the movement wasn't able to change that. The upcoming parliamentary elections that are happening in a couple of weeks are perhaps the most restricted in the history of the Islamic Republic in some ways, certainly since the 80s or 90s. The enforcement of hijab mandatory veiling on the streets is worse than ever, although there is the most visible survival of the movement, if you will, is a campaign of mass disobedience by millions of women who just don't wear the hijab anymore. And some of them pay a very high price for it. And they're thrown in jail, they're lashed, terrible things are done to them because they're doing this, or more mundane things like they're fined, their cars are towed, there's security cameras that do face recognition. So they tow your car, basically, if you're not wearing your veil, even inside your car. So, in this regard, the movement wasn't able to really change the government. And I mean, that people are not on the streets anymore. But I think the movement really opened up questions of political change and political future of the Islamic Republic in an unprecedented way. Basic questions like, what is the place of nationality for Iranians? How do they deal with their differences with each other? What kind of country do they want? How can the different groups in the country work together? I think it opened all of this up. It really showed the failure of the abroad-based opposition itself as sort of a political lesson. So I think it's hard to make the case that that movement on its own is still going on, but it certainly made a mark in Iranian political history, and it will definitely color all the future attempts for change. It's a bit like 1905 revolution in Russia. It finishes in 1905 or maybe 1906, but obviously by the time the 1917 happens, and everyone ends up seeing this in a continuum. And I think this movement will be seen in a long continuum of a variety of movements against the Islamic Republic that have been going on, particularly since 2009. But, you know, let me be clear, though, just because I compare it to 1905 doesn't mean I'm optimistic that there necessarily will be, you know, another revolution to dislodge this regime. In fact, I don't think that's necessarily likely, although that's certainly what, you know, I believe in and I will struggle for. But as in sort of a, if I'm to put on sort of a, you know, pessimism of intellect as opposed to the optimism of will, I would say that it's not, you know, it's not clear that that's where the political change in Iran will come from. But it certainly continues as a reference, and it will, you know, if there's sort of a revolutionary palimpsest, if you will, for Iranians, it certainly has a very, you know, very important place as in the future we try to challenge the government and try to change it.
Let me ask about this. Global media attention focused pretty overwhelmingly on the mandatory hijab aspect of the movement. Indeed, you know, many headlines referred to them as hijab protests, which was a contested term. But you devote a lot of the book to other aspects of the movement. For example, you have a whole chapter on the role of labor struggles, which received almost no attention in Western media coverage. So tell us about this aspect of the movement.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I wrote the book, frankly. You know, if you ask me, you know, why I wrote the book, it's because I was frustrated by a portrayal of the movement that was very flat, if you will. It's as if, you know, it had no history, and also it had no, you know, it was, okay, women are coming out and they're against this mandatory veiling, which was an important part of the movement, but it wasn't all about that. I mean, this was a multifaceted movement that had been, that had roots in decades of civil society struggles in Iran. And the working class and trade union struggles are very, very important and very key. Now, the modern trade union movement in Iran, by modern, I mean, I should better say sort of contemporary, the recent trade union movement in Iran really gets going in the late 90s and has had an important role in the last 20 years. You know, that's sort of what I talk about in the book. But more importantly, you know, Iranians in 2009, those who were perceptive, doesn't matter whether you're on the left or right, those who are perceptive came to understand that what was really lacking in the movement was a general strike, a sort of mass disruption of life by labor, who could deliver a sort of a final blow to the regime. That this was very important. And as I said, people, even sort of analysts on who were liberal or not necessarily on the left, they really understood this.
And that was critical, by the way, in the 1977, 78, and 79 protests that led to the revolution in the first place, right? The role of oil workers, for example, and the general strikes that took place were precipitated by many accounts the Shah's departure.
Absolutely. In fact, that's one of the reasons why Iranians were very sort of aware of this, right? They had a historical memory of 1979, you know, not only in a sort of a general sense, in the very visceral, like the last few months and weeks in 1979 would have been impossible without the oil workers. And other sort of working class elements that came out. And at the time, a lot of them were under the influence of the Communist Tudor Party and sort of other socialist parties. So they had a strong organizing traditions, you know, not all of which are unfortunately present now. But at any rate, people understood the general strike that is very important. There was a general strike called in December for 3 days. Now, it wasn't very successful everywhere. In Kurdistan, where the left-wing elements are stronger, it was successful. It sort of shut down Kurdistan for a few days. It wasn't as successful in other places. But in the book, I'm also quite critical. I try to sort of explain what I call middle-class prejudices, if you will, in Iran, that a lot of people didn't understand. There has been a lack of political education. They don't understand how the working class is supposed to work, what are trade unions. I'll give you an interesting example. For example, there were people who, you know, when workers would shut down a factory, there were some well-meaning, you know, young revolutionaries who would be like, well, why do they just shut down a factory? Why don't they come out to the street to protest? I mean, that's what really matters. Not understanding that actually, you know, the power of the working class, the power of its organizations like trade unions, you know, everyone can come to the street. What is special about the workers is that they're able to shut down production, which is much more important than just having people on the street. So, you know, It's a chapter that really shows the promise and the heroism of the Iranian trade union movement, of the unprecedented links that it was able to build across society throughout this movement. I think it was very fascinating. Labor leaders like Ismail Bakhshi, like Shahabi, like Madadi, they became, you know, well-known national names. But really, we don't really have yet a powerful trade union movement that really unites large parts of the country's working class in, you know, brings them together, something like, you know, COSATU in South Africa during the struggles against apartheid. We're not really quite there yet, but we do have all the elements, and the workers activists in Iran who really work under tremendous repression have heroically been able to have links all over the place. So any future change in Iran, of course, would have to take that into account and you know, integrate a nationwide labor movement into an oppositional strategy if it wants to overcome the Islamic Republic.
Parash, you recently wrote that political repression in Iran, and you mentioned this in this conversation as well, in passing, but you recently wrote that political repression in Iran has reached new heights, and that a feeling of despondence and anger pervades Iranian society. Let's take those one at a time. Talk about the extent of political repression in Iran since fall 2022.
Yeah, the repression is very extensive. During the movement, they jailed successfully, impressively from the perspective of the regime. They jailed 8,000 at some point, I think up to 15,000 and more. At every given time, there were a few thousand. And these were sort of movers and shakers everywhere, right? Anyone who had any chance of leading anything, right? Civic activists, even like filmmakers, actresses, they put them in prison. And they processed them within the judiciary. That means that even when they come out, now they have, you know, they come out on bail. They're much more restricted in their activity. So that happened throughout the movement and has continued afterwards. And when things went down a little bit, they started executing. So they executed a number of people. And even in the lead up to the elections, sometimes the lead up to the parliamentary elections and stuff, they would ease up the repression. Not this time around. Mohammad Qobadlu is the last young man who was executed because of his role in the protests. Others are on the death row. And there have also been, so there has been an even more strict hijab law passed in the conservative dominated parliament, and the presence of security forces everywhere has increased, as I said. And also the elections, interestingly enough, the elections for the Assembly of Experts, so that's the body that picks the supreme leader, and the parliamentary elections, which are due to take place on the same day, on March 1st, these are, as I mentioned before, super restricted. I mean, elections have never been free and fair in the Islamic Republic, but these are sort of unprecedented to the degree to which they've excluded even centrist sort of conservatives who were slightly critical of the administration of Raisi, the current president of Iran. As Iran is sort of preparing itself for the succession moment, the Ayatollah Khamenei is supreme leader. He's going to be 85 soon. He's going to die at some point. As the regime is preparing for that moment, it's really closed up all bodies, filled them with hardliners. So it really does feel like a sort of unprecedented repression. It's not unprecedented, but, you know, it's not quite as bad as the 1980s, frankly, still, but it's unprecedented for the current generation in many ways. But also the despondence part is at least as important as the repression part. So it's not just that there's a lot of repression, that it definitely is, but that people have, you know, lost hope because of all the movements that you mentioned. I mean, they've experienced, like someone like me, I'm 36, you know, I've lived through all the movements you mentioned. And so people who've actually lived in Iran throughout this period, they've seen like four massive defeats of street movements. And there were also electoral pathways, right? So a lot of us voted previously for candidates who we had hopes could change things a little bit, like Hassan Rouhani, the previous centrist president. But all of them have gone on the defeat. So there's a big feeling of despondence in society, and many are leaving the country. And of course, we might be surprised at any point there might be another uprising. There's definitely hopes for that. There are lots of signs of resilience in Iranian society that makes one not lose hope. But there's certainly a lot of feelings about a lot of feelings of desperation and despondence. It's not hard to see why.
You note that participants in the movement and Iranians throughout the diaspora who supported it, quote, have found themselves with a persistent and familiar question. Why did we fail? How has the Islamic Republic survived? So maybe those are two questions, if related ones. Let's take them one at a time. Why did the movement fail, in your view?
I think that this answer is not very hard, actually, frankly. I think it's a sort of a bit, I don't think it's a very difficult question to answer. We failed because the opposition to the Islamic Republic failed to bring about anything like a coherent alternative to this regime. You know, governments don't just fall. Now, there are regimes in the world in which when things get a little tough, the head of a state packs up his bags and gets on a plane and leaves, right? That's how Ben Ali left Tunisia. That's how Mubarak was, in a way, forced to resign in Egypt, although, you know, other elements kept the country together. But Khamenei is not a guy like that. He is a revolutionary, genuine revolutionary. He's dedicated all his life to revolution. I know that in some of your work, you've contested the sort of meaning of revolutionary and counter-revolutionary, and I agree with you largely there in other countries. But my point is that he is an ideological, genuine revolutionary by which he really believes in the ideas that that has hold the regime together, and he's not going to leave. I mean, he's 84, right? Where is he going to go? So this regime was not going to collapse under its own and lead into some sort of an indeterminate situation in which then we'll see who enters in. This is not the sort of fall you were going to have in Iran. You had it in some countries, as I mentioned before, like Tunisia and others. You were not going to have it in Iran. So the only way would be for the opposition to be able to come together, unite across the very real differences that it has, and present a coherent, organized alternative to the regime. Now, it had every opportunity to do this. You know, few revolutionaries have had so much going for them when you really think about it. Because, first of all, I'll give you a very quick sort of list. First of all, the Iranian opposition has almost unlimited access to media that any revolutionary could have dreamed of. There are media outlets now funded by different governments, Europeans, Saudis, Americans. And but, you know, the net result is that Iranian opposition, these are all media that are open to Iranian opposition, staffed by the Iranian opposition, journalists with sympathies with Iranian opposition. So they could broadcast to Iran anything that they wanted at any time I don't know how many times in history this has been possible, but this certainly was the possibility. It also had the reality that the Islamic Republic is so bad and so hated across such wide range of people that it's kind of amazing that it has survived. It's not economically successful. It's not sort of competent. Its ideology doesn't have much going for it. I said Khamenei is a genuine revolutionary, but the new generations really are not. I believe even the hardliners, I would argue, are not really so much vetted to all the nuances of the sort of Islamist ideology. They're much more, they're sort of much more opportunistic elements. And if you look at the opponents of this regime, it includes not just the left, the right, economically left, economically right, different ethnic minorities in the country, none of which, you know, whose leadership is really on the side of the regime, but also major former elements of the regime. And in which other country you have a situation in which a former prime minister, like Mousavi, was a favorite, as I said, of Ayatollah Khomeini, founder of the regime. He has now called for an end to the regime, effectively, as have many other former officials. So you have all these great elements, but the Iranian opposition failed to come together to present a coherent alternative. And frankly, it failed to even do 5% of the job of presenting a coherent alternative. If you do it 100% right, you still have a very difficult job because it's a very difficult thing to wage a revolution and win against the entrenched government, right? So long as a government is willing to kill its opponents, as Khamenei is, it's very difficult to dislodge it from power. It has tens of thousands of men in uniform. Of course, a job of a revolution is to be able to attract some of those men in uniform. That's how revolutions win. But if you do everything right, it's still very difficult. But the Iranian opposition not only didn't do everything right, it didn't do anything right. It failed, as I said, to to come together to present an alternative. And this is the abroad-based opposition I'm talking about.
Yeah, please. Draw that distinction between the opposite, because I think most people assume that you're talking about the movement inside Iran, but you're also talking about the diaspora. And I have a whole question about that, which is the subject of a forthcoming article that you've written for New Lines magazine. Be clear about which side of the opposition you're criticizing, the internal opposition within Iran or the diaspora?
Yeah, so I mean, it's important. It's a very good question and a contentious question. It's also important how we draw the distinction, because those abroad, after all, they were inside not that long ago, many of them, right? We're not talking about people who were exiled. I mean, yes, some have been abroad for like 40 years, right? But many are more recent, people who left after 2009 Green Movement or shortly before that, right? So they, you know, this sort of disease of not organizing and not bringing about, not cohering an alternative, as I said, is not limited. It's not just sort of a diasporic ailment, if you will. But the difference is those in abroad had the opportunity to organize, right? Because they're not hounded by the regime. Now, those inside, figures like Narges Mohammadi, the great human rights activist who won the Nobel Peace Prize last year, figure like Nasrin Sotoudeh, another human rights lawyer, figure like Ismail Bakhshi, the labor leader that I talked about, and many others, they, as soon as they do anything, they're arrested. It's very clear why they're not able to organize, right? Because as I said, the regime very effectively bans. You know, the regime has been really precise about this. Let's say something like Association of Iranian Writers. You know, if you really allowed Association of Iranian Writers to cohere and to sort of organize, I doubt it would be able to bring down the government, right? It's a bunch of, writers, most of whom are pretty old, or a lot of them are pretty old. But you know, but the Iranian regime doesn't even allow the Association of Iranian Writers to meet. If they meet in someone's home, right? If 30 Iranian writers go and meet in someone's home, the regime will enter and break it down, right? This, as has happened before, so it's very effectively disrupts all formation of civil society inside Iran. But those abroad who have the opportunity have failed to come together and bring about an alternative. And the question is why, right? And the answer to this why, I think a large section of it is that, unfortunately, Iranians have been miseducated and miseducating themselves in the past few decades in this idea that a good movement should be horizontal, that you don't need leaders, that organizations are thing of the past, that having sort of political ideologies is passé, that really, if you just come together, choose the right hashtag, insist on your moral righteousness, and ask the governments of the world to sort of boycott the Islamic Republic, the regime will somehow collapse on its own. And of course, it's nonsense. Now, this is nonsensical in any situation, as I think that, and this is behind much of the failures of many uprisings in the last decade. Vincent Bevins has a very good book about this, about sort of what he calls the missing revolution of 2010s. He looks at the Arab world as well. But in case of Iran, it's particularly disastrous because guess what? The Iranian regime is organized to the core. It's not going to get away by your... And also, it's as internationally isolated as it comes. It doesn't have sort of a reliance on the international community the way some other regimes might have. So really, if you have a chance, you have to organize and also come over the differences. Be able to overcome the differences that you will inevitably have. Fight not about the past, but, agree on the future. And these are all the things in which the political leadership of the opposition failed to do. But
not all of them were horizontalists, right? Like many in the Iranian diaspora cohered behind the figure of Reza Pahlavi, the son of the late Shah, and the heir to the Peacock Throne, but you point out that and he did play a role in the organizing that went on in the opposition. You talk about the convening of various exile opposition figures that was held at Georgetown University in February of 2023, which led to the launch of a new organization called the Alliance for Freedom and Democracy in Iran, AFDI. So tell us about these various groups and personalities at that table and how it went down in flames so quickly.
It definitely is very good to point out that, of course, not everyone was a horizontalist. However, the ideas, sort of ideas that, you know, you don't really need an organization, that you don't really need a leadership, this was very prevalent in Iranian society. And I think it accounted for the failure of FDI, which I'll partially at least accounted for that, in which I'll explain in a minute about, right? Now, as for Reza Pahlavi was able to really emerge as a very leading opposition figure for a short period in late 2022 and early 2023. And I think the reason for that was that he basically started a rhetoric that was pretty successful, I have to say. It was very broadly liberal democratic. He spoke about a couple of things that Iranians can all agree on: keeping of the territorial integrity of a country, adherence to human rights, democracy for the future of Iran. He showed a willingness to talk to the political opposition and not just be restricted to sort of his father's past. But unfortunately, even though he did the talk, he didn't walk the walk, which I'll explain to you what I mean by this. You know, Reza Pahlavi was and is surrounded by people who are very opposite of the sort of broadly liberal democratic rhetoric that he's often used. There are far-right, frankly, fascistic figures. And I really don't use this term lightly, right? I'm not just using it. I say this as someone who had some hopes for some in some period that maybe Pahlavi could play a role. But these far-right fascistic figures are those who very, you know, very strongly would attack all elements of the opposition that they didn't like. In fact, they mostly attacked the opposition more than the regime even. They would attack, you know, anybody who was anywhere close to the left, you know, center-left, anybody who was what they considered Republican, i.e. not a monarchist, not in favor of restoring monarchy in Iran, which I have to add, even Pahlavi, one of the elements of his success was that he didn't insist that he wants to be king or he wants to restore the monarchy. He would say that it should be left to sort of a constitutional assembly to decide what the future of Iran will be. But Pahlavi, ultimately, you know, they say personal is policy. All around him, the people that surrounded him, his chief of staff, you know, all the figures close to him espoused not the sort of inclusive politics that he claimed he would stand for, but the sort of far-right exclusionary politics. Now, the Alliance for Freedom of Democracy in Iran came together when Pahlavi and a few others joined and built a coalition together. This was a very promising moment. You know, I supported it from the beginning myself. This was Masih Ali Nejad, a feminist sort of journalist and a campaigner against compulsory hijab. Nazanin Bunyadi, a great human rights activist, and so, you know, she's an actor, but also has been a human rights activist for a long time. There was Shirin Ebadi, the winner of Nobel Peace Prize. There was Abdullah Mohtadi, the leader of a major leftist Kurdish political party. He used to be the founding secretary general of the Communist Party of Iran, and now he's the leader of a major Kurdish party. And a few at Hamed Esmailiun, who really has emerged as sort of a moral leader. He is the head of the Association of the Families of the Ukrainian Flight that you spoke about. So he lost his daughter and his wife in that flight. And, you know, as sort of he used to be a very well-known writer, actually, those of us who follow Iranian fiction would. And so these figures all came together. And this was a very important moment, Danny. This was the most important gathering of the Iranian opposition figures together, even though it had a very important flaw. You notice this was effectively a gathering of political celebrities. It was not that of organizations. So Mr. Pahlavi, yes, he's not a horizontalist, I don't think, nor are his sort of far-right supporters, but they've never built an organization, right? They have what is called the New Iran Party, for example, that is named after a party that was active in Iran in the 1970s under the Shah. But this New Iran Party is, you know, it's, as we used to sort of joke about a small leftist groups, is three guys and a dog, right? It's by which I mean, you know, it's you know, I mean, I don't know how many members do they actually have, but maybe it's 50, maybe it's 100, which is the same as most other so-called political organizations. So this was a flaw from the beginning. But Danny, what happened to this Alliance for Freedom and Democracy in Iran? It came together in this very hopeful moment. There was the Georgetown Conference. They promised they're going to write a charter together and declare a new association, which was this alliance that you mentioned. It collapsed in, you know, not in 6 months, not in 1 year, not it goes dormant and nothing happens. It collapsed amidst recriminations and attacks on each other in a matter of weeks. Frankly, it was a truly embarrassing moment for everyone involved. How embarrassing it is. I mean, if you I don't know, if I come together with my friends and say, let's play football every Wednesday in a field, I'm sure we can keep it going on for more than a few weeks, right? But in this case, the whole thing came down, and I don't want to put all the blame on supporters of Reza Pahlavi, although clearly I think they had a key role in attacking each other, but also supporters of other figures in this coalition who attacked each other vehemently. And you know what is very sad? You would say, okay, let's say Pahlavi supporters couldn't get on together with supporters of Masih or Hamid Ismailian and others. Well, let's have two councils. Maybe, you know, there will be one for him and one for others. But even that didn't occur. I.e., when Pahlavi left, and you know, I detailed this in the article in New Lines, others also left. They didn't even form something together. And here we are. We're talking about in February 2024. Nothing new has been founded. It's remarkable. I just wrote an article in Persian about Alexei Navalny, the brave leader of the Russian opposition who died in custody in Russian prison. And when you compare all the associations that Russians, despite much worse conditions than Iranians, I think, much worse in terms that they, you know, Putin is a global leader. The Russian state has a seat in the Security Council. I mean, they face much more adverse conditions. Yet they have tons of organizations that they founded, some of which really has some, does some real work. Whereas the Iranian opposition, unfortunately, has, outside human rights organizations and media outlets, has not been able to found successful political efforts. To go back to your question of how has the regime survived despite all of its unpopularity, despite all its sort of failures, I think the answer is very simple. The regime has survived because it lacks an effective opposition. And I should add, it lacks even 5 or 10% of an effective political opposition. And until Iranians are able to get their act together and build such an alternative, the regime will survive. And even if it doesn't survive, the movers and shakers, those who will change it and sort of bring about changes, will not be the people and their associations and their organizations, but those of the regime.
So, Arash, let's talk about how October 7th has changed the equation. The aftermath of October 7th, what has it meant for Iran, and how the regional equation has changed. This one aspect of it, of course, is that the so-called axis of resistance seems to have made a comeback. That narrative had become moribund in the face of Iran's support for the Assad regime, and also its role in the 2019 uprisings in Iraq and Lebanon, which, as you know, I've characterized as counter-revolutionary, contrary to the widespread view across the ideological spectrum that the Islamic Republic is a revolutionary force in the region. I mean, you made this point yourself in The Shadow Commander, where you note that Iran oriented itself to the Arab Spring, not in the spirit of revolutionary fraternity, but with cold calculation worthy of a scheming monarch. Despite the words that came out of his mouth, Khamenei was now more of a sultan than a revolutionary. But now, Arash, since October 7th, all seems to have been forgiven in a sense, because the so-called resistance forces are mobilized in support of the Palestinian cause. How do you see this? Is the axis of resistance back? Is it a category that has salience at this point, or is it a mystification that serves to whitewash not only Iran's policies in places like Syria and Iraq, but also the role of its allies like Hezbollah, the Shia militias in Iraq and beyond?
This is a really excellent question. It has a couple of moving pieces, really. So let me talk about it briefly. First of all, the axis of resistance was supposed to be a global coalition of forces that want to bring about a Khomeinist Islamist revolution, right? That is really what it's supposed to be originally. And in that sense, it has manifestly failed for a long time, because its forces, even Hezbollah in Lebanon, has basically realized that it can't bring about an Islamist system in a multi-confessional country like Lebanon, and has ceased trying, right? Its ideology used to be based on that, and it doesn't do that. And frankly, the Islamic Republic in Iran is such a failure that it would be very hard with a straight face to say, yes, this is a particular governing model that we want to advocate for. So really, acts of resistance has, in the years of sectarianism, you know, as you explain in your own former book, in the years where we had a sectarization of Middle East politics, the acts of resistance was reduced effectively to a bit of sectarian forces. They were Shia forces in a situation of sectarian civil war. And of course, Hamas basically left the axis of resistance as a result of this, because it wouldn't back the suppression of Muslim Brotherhood in Syria by a what they considered to be a sort of a Shia president, Alawite president. No, I don't think Hamas is sectarian, by the way. I want to clarify this. And I don't think even Islamic Republic is necessarily sectarian. I think they have sectarian elements, but, you know, it's sort of a complicated issue. But at any rate, I mean, the axis had been reduced to that. No, but there is one thing that the Axis really does have going for it, and that's the truth, and is that these are the only forces that fight Israel, that are ready to fire bullets against Israel, fight Israel not just with words, but with weapons. When you think about it, the only force on this planet who is doing that is the Axis of Resistance. Now, the other countries can say loud words. You know, Jordan and Egypt can denounce Israel. Algeria and Tunisia can abstain from resolutions. But who is actually giving weapons to Palestinian militant groups and fighting Israel with weapons? It's only the Islamic Republic of Iran, and it's only these forces. So naturally, in a moment like this, October 7th was a comeback for them. But here's where the problems begin. Because, okay, why do you think all the other Arab countries stopped fighting Israel? Because they realized there is not a military strategy with which they can defeat the Israeli state in the current configuration of the world, right? Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan. I mean, Egypt signed a peace treaty with Israel in 1979. Now, when Egypt had a Muslim Brotherhood president, was the first thing that the Muslim Brotherhood president did? He said, we're going to honor the 1979 peace treaty with Egypt. And, you know, you can have... a lot of Egyptians feel very closely with, against the massacre of Palestinians that is happening in Gaza, the brutal massacre and war criminal massacre of Palestinians in Gaza. But do they, Egypt is not a democratic country anyway, so they don't have much say in this. And it's not clear to me that actually if it was democratic, they'd like a new war against Israel. Anyways, we can't do hypotheticals. But so this brings me to the fact that, okay, so these forces of the Axis, yes, they fire shots at Israel and they arm Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad that can actually fight Israel. And, you know, the Houthis shoot a couple of missiles at, vaguely Israeli-related ships. I mean, they're not really fighting Israel. You know, they lobbed a couple of missiles at Eilat in southern Israel, but it's sort of too far. And the Iraqis have done a couple of shots. And sure, Hezbollah obviously has fought a war against Israel in 2006. No, but it brings us to the question that, okay, what is the military strategy of these groups against Israel? And this gets very interesting. Because actually, Danny, Islamic Republic, since October 7, has had one preoccupation in the region, and that's not fighting Israel, right? The biggest worry and concern that the Islamic Republic has is that it gets into a direct confrontation with Israel and the United States. It wants to avoid that at all costs. It knows that there are elements in the Israeli government that want that, in the Israeli politics that want that. There are obviously elements in American political life that want that, although very, very few. I think there's no appetite for it in the United States. So the Islamic Republic has effectively tried to keep the leash on these non-state actors in Yemen and Iraq and other places, and Hezbollah, to make sure they don't get into a direct confrontation with Israel. So yes, it was a comeback. It did lead to a lot of popularity of the Axis forces, but at the same time, it also actually questions their legitimacy. Imagine you are, for example, people who look on Hezbollah and the speeches of Hassan Nasrallah, by this point have become a bit of a point of a joke for many. Like, okay, when is he going to do anything against Israel? Why doesn't he open a serious northern front against Israel? Now, there is some fighting there, as you know. Hezbollah has lost dozens of fighters since October 7. But it's not engaging Israel in a real fight like 2006. And there are actually elements in Iran who are saying the same thing to Khamenei. Hardline elements to Iran that, hey, Khamenei, why are you exercising caution? I'll give you an example. Amine Sadat Zabihpour, she is a notorious TV anchor in the state TV in Iran. She's known for, remember Esmail Bakhshi that I mentioned earlier, the labor leader. She's known for having made a quote-unquote documentary about him that was effectively a sort of a hatchet job of attacking him as a spy and stuff. So she's a well-known anchor. She effectively tweeted in the, you know, in October, why are they Palestinian children dying while our missiles are resting at home, right? Basically, it's like, why are we not fighting Israel? And that's one example. And there are tons of people. You know, Iranian TV had this dual life, right? Not just TV, but the Islamic Republic, its entire propaganda apparatus had a dual reality. Every day they would air programs about how Israel's destruction will come, how they'll destroy Israel, they'll turn Haifa and Tel Aviv into parking lots. But, you know, ineffectively, they're begging these forces not to fight Israel, not to get Iran into a confrontation with Israel. And this is very clear. I mean, they've gone out of their way to do that. Because, of course, Khamenei is, yes, he's a general revolutionary, as I said, but he's also a strategic thinker historically. And another way of putting it is that he's a bit of a coward, frankly. I mean, he knows he can't get into a fight with Israel and win. So he doesn't want to get into a fight. So here's the situation. The acts of resistance found a moment of success, but it's a moment of crisis because it doesn't actually have a military strategy to win against Israel. So its popularity can only go so far. And inside Iran, at any rate, as I explained in the chapter in the book, again, regardless of what you want to think about Iranians, you can think whatever you want about them, but they're not in favor of this axis. They're not in favor of this foreign military policy of the Islamic Republic, and they're not particularly in favor of arming groups against Israel. And the reason for that is not that they're pro-Israel or not. It's for the simple reason that this foreign policy has brought them nothing but economic misery and international isolation. It's really not been good for Iranians in any shape or form. So they don't support the foreign policy of the government. And in fact, now serious elements, not just in the population, but even in the Iranian establishment, have lost respect for Khamenei in many ways because they believe he's gotten Iran into a situation where we are in a danger of a war. We're arming Russia against Ukraine. We are going into confrontation with Israel and the United States when no Arab country does that, right? No sovereign Arab state is doing that, but Iran is doing that. And also we just had a fight with Pakistan, as you know, exchange of fire with Pakistan and the eastern borders. So they have an idea of you know, one thing Iranians don't want historically, and I really think this is not just people, but even elements in the establishment. They don't want a war. They don't want Iran. We have experienced a brutal war in the 1980s with Iraq, you know, 8 long years where a lot of us lost, you know, family members and you know, a lot of our loved ones to drive out the Iraqi invaders out of our country in 1980s. They don't want Iranians don't want another war, and they're very worried that this atmosphere of war in the region has meant that Khamenei has put our country under the threat of entering another war, and they want to avoid that. So the longest or short of it is that the October 7 has not actually been something positive in any way for the Islamic Republic. It has not helped its domestic legitimacy. In fact, it's done it worse. Conversely, Khamenei, who was supposed to be a great strategist, according to his supporters, has managed to, you know, make himself kind of lose the respect of not just those who oppose his foreign policy, but even some of those who previously supported it, but don't support getting Iran into a conflict that it obviously cannot win.
Arash Azizi, thank you very much for joining us on The Lead. This has been The Lead, a podcast from New Lines magazine. You can find Arash on Twitter at @Arash_Tehran. This week's episode was produced by Finbar Anderson and hosted by me, Danny Postel. For more episodes like this, subscribe to The Lead on your favorite podcast app or visit our website, newlinesmag.com. Thank you all for joining us.